All right, welcome back to our first ever AMR Overtures discussion. My name is Joel St. Clair, and I'm a pastor in Silver Spring, Maryland, and an executive board member of the Alliance for Mission and Renewal. The AMR cares deeply about the PCA, and we put in time and energy to work toward or foster a unified and faithful PCA. And part of how we're doing that today is through having discussions with David Coffin, Fred Greco, and Howie Donahoe about overtures. That is an ask typically from one of our 87 presbyteries to the General Assembly. For an amendment to our constitutional standards or to take action, do something different. And today we're having our third discussion on some of the overtures that have been submitted for this upcoming 52nd General Assembly in Chattanooga. We are going to be looking at in this third discussion. A handful of overtures, and I'm going to kind of clump them together. Maybe we can talk about voting, jurisdiction, and membership. So, some of the overtures that touch on voting, jurisdiction, membership, maybe a category of like process. And so, we're going to be covering a number of these with each of you having the opportunity to weigh in. Thanks so much for joining us. As we kick off, I want to make sure before we highlight any of the overtures where there may be disagreement or where we talk through in the overtures themselves, which are linked below, as well as the guides that each of these men have written independently, where they've shared their thought in detail, oftentimes with maybe amendments that would make the overtures better or reasons or rationale for why they are voting in one way or in the other. There is quite a bit of agreement in those guides, which are linked below. In fact, in overtures 6, 7, 10, 11, 13, 14, 15, 16, 19, 22, 23, 25, 27, 28, 31, 32, 33, 35, 37, and 40, they pretty much recommend the same answer, except sometimes with varying reasons why. And so when we pick out a handful of overtures to talk about voting or jurisdiction or membership or area process that there may be some disagreement, I just want to recognize that that comes really in the setting of quite a bit of agreement. And so let's pick it up together with Overture 7. This is an overture that comes from Missouri Presbytery, and it's really an overture to amend BCO 34:1, which is known by some as kind of the paragraph that oversees original jurisdiction or the assumption of original jurisdiction. Now, in your guides, I'll note that for Overture 7, Howie Donahoe recommended voting in the negative on this. Fred Greco recommended the negative. And then, David, your answer, I don't want to categorize it because lest I mess up and miscategorize it. So, would you tell us what are your thoughts here about Overture 7?
In 1879, this paragraph said, "Process against a minister shall be entered before the presbytery of which he's a member, period." And that strikes me as just the right place and just the right amount of words for this section. The language that's there now was added because of a case in the Southern Church, where a very famous professor was becoming derelict in his views. His presbytery wouldn't do anything about it, and the PCA decided they wanted to do something, have something to do about they lived with it only applying to ministers until about 1988. In the first study committee that I served on as a ruling elder, the Committee on Restructure, somebody finally noticed that this wasn't applicable to ruling elders in Chapter 33, and so we wrote a version of it. In fact, we wrote a better version of it than the one that's in 34:1. And because it's different, it caused a good bit of confusion. But in any case, I helped to do that, and so I'm a guilty party here. Because I think this is a very, very bad provision, and I'd like to see the Overtures Committee, in fact, just strike all of that language. I think it's ill-considered because in chapter 40, there are remedies where someone can bring something before the assembly if they need be. If there's no person in that presbytery that will act when there's some dereliction with respect to another minister, we have a much greater problem than simply one person. But my main concern is there is no way to have anything remotely akin to due process or an evidentiary standard. It simply says if people say there's a bad thing, and a number of them, a relatively small number, and the assembly can take a jurisdiction. I don't think this is a proposal that's likely at all to lead to justice. And I don't think it even has very much usefulness in helping to protect the presbyteries. And I think the alternatives that we have are just and will perfectly accommodate what is intended by these paragraphs in 33 and 34.
Thanks so much. Howie, Fred, responses, thoughts, anything you'd add?
I've been trying to change this paragraph for almost 20 years. Refuses to act is too vague. Two or three presbyteries is too low. I think I've tried unsuccessfully a couple times. I think if we said change refuses to act, it declines to indict, and bump it up to 15 to 20% of the presbyteries, it would pass and it would solve a lot of problems.
So is that what you mean? Can you just clarify just for me even, two to three presbyteries too low? Are you thinking when this was
Wait.
originally written, the number of
No,
presbyteries there were at that time, and
it's
that's why
way
you would
too low.
favor? Okay.
No, it's way too low. I mean, if there's I'll give you an example. I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a high profile case out of St. Louis, and the presbytery declined to indict. That was so high profile, it wouldn't have been hard for 15% of the presbyteries to petition for assumption of original jurisdiction. If it's not a problem, or if it is a big problem, shouldn't be hard to get 15% of the presbyteries. And that would have procedurally dealt with that thing a whole lot easier.
Hey, Fred, before I jump over to you, can I just ask Howie on the fly here? I can imagine that there are some who would say creating a higher bar creates the need to incite others to act, to share
Sure.
details, to potentially present one
Yeah.
side of a case in order to get a presbytery because,
Yeah.
hey, we need this 15 or 20%. So I
Yeah.
just, it with use of social media today, with how I think of a unified and faithful PCA as one that is operating with some level of trust in
Yeah.
our fellow
Yeah.
presbyters. Can you, how is that a
Yeah.
concern if you jump that bar up?
Yeah.
And
Well,
what do you think about that?
happy to respond to that because what I would say is, all that social media stuff's going to happen anyway. It did happen in the case I referenced. This, at worst, would mitigate some of that. I mean, people send an email to some friend in another presbytery and say, "Hey, see if you can get your presbytery to petition for AOJ." Right? You don't have to do that on social media. I mean, hopefully, if it's done expeditiously, it keeps stuff off of social media.
Yeah, AOJ being
Because,
the assumption of original jurisdiction there.
yeah,
Yeah. Fred,
but a
Howie,
lot.
first, thanks for just like what I hear you saying is like some of this, it's baked into the pie of American Presbyterianism already. Certainly in the 21st century, like it's
Yeah,
in
I mean,
there.
if it's a doctrinal matter or a case of scandal, it's on the internet. You can't stop it,
That's right.
unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think I'm not as optimistic as Howie would be because we tried last time together, and the PCA found a way to reject both of us at the same time. We couldn't clear two-thirds of the presbyteries was where it failed. That's a really high bar in doing that. And so, there was, for example, there was another high-ish profile case at the exact same time that the case was coming out of St. Louis. People forget that there were other requests for assumption of original jurisdiction. And it may be that the solution is what David has suggested, which is to use review and control under 40-5. It's never been done before in that exact vein, but that may be the solution. But I think this overture needs to die a much quicker death than ours did, because I think not only will it not pass, if it did pass, this isn't a good solution for a number of reasons.
Okay. Fair. Thanks, each of you. So moving on to Overture 9. Overture 9 comes from James River. It is an amendment in the categories of like jurisdiction membership. This would be under voting for Overture number 9, an amendment to BCO 14.1 on how the AC functions with regard to votes. In this for Overture 9, Howie, I'm going to ask if you would kick us off here on a conversation. What are your thoughts about Overture 9 and amending BCO 14 and impacting how AC, how the voting process goes there?
I'll try to be quick. I wrote kind of a lengthy rationale in my recommendation that it be answered the negative. So I'll just highlight four things. One, it was also referred to all the permanent committees and agency boards, and eight of the nine of them recommended answering James River 9 in the negative. MNA and recommended answering in the affirmative, but didn't give ground. So I don't know what makes the difference, but. The second thing is I think it's like a lot of things, probably some of the things I actually have written, it's a solution in search of a problem, because to my knowledge, I don't remember, and I've been to 33 GAs, I don't remember a time when a committee of commissioners on admin committee recommended a substantially different thing than the admin committee itself, which means the admin committee's been functioning pretty well. The third thing is that if this passed, it would shrink the admin committee from 20 voting members to 11. And I think that kind of centralizes power more than diffuses it. And it's usually the opposite of what we argue for. I'll give you an example. There's 11 members of the permanent committee, other than the designees from the agencies and boards. And one presbytery has two men on the AC committee, two out of the 11. And that presbytery, well, there's 30 presbyteries in the PCA that have more churches than that presbytery. So two guys in one relatively smaller presbytery with voting positions on the AC. So, I mean, I think it'd be a different overture if it said disenfranchise the designees, but bump the whole AC up to 20 or 30 members or something. So I think it's a bad idea to shrink it to 11.
Okay.
And partly because the designees are men that were elected by some a General Assembly to be on that permanent committee. So it's not like the permanent committee found some guy. They're all elected by the GA. Now, they weren't elected to function as an AC member. Their permanent committee is the one that designated them for that, but still they were elected by the GA, so.
Thanks,
On
Howie.
this
one, I think it's helpful to be reminded of what I take to be a fundamental principle, and that is, with respect to any overture, the burden of proof is on the proposer. They have the obligation to show that there's a good reason for doing this. And as far as I can see, there's no evidence that the current scheme causes any kinds of difficulties at all. They certainly didn't propose it in the overture. And that in itself, I think, is enough reason to vote against it.
Fred, you have thoughts?
One main thought that I've had and I put in my commentary is one of the reasons, maybe the main reason, all of the permanent committees recommended against it was that they didn't want to lose their vote on their budgets because the budgets are approved by the administrative committee. And that actually jogged for me something. I'm not sure why, for example, we're only giving one MTW representative a vote out of 20 on the large MTW budget. That doesn't seem to make any sense at all to me. I would like to see us change that. I don't see any reason why the MTW budget, which is not unified with the other budgets, couldn't come up through the MTW committee of commissioners. And the same with M&A, and the same with Geneva, and the same with the AC. It seems to me that that would not really take up much more time on the assembly floor. It would enfranchise the permanent committees much more, give them much more say and control than that. If I were, M&A, I wouldn't want one out of 20 votes. I'd want 10 out of 10 votes or 12 out of 12 votes on my budget.
Oh, it may actually save some time, Fred, because we waste time every year with people trying to figure out whether we should pass
Yes.
budget during the committee's time
Yes.
or whether it's waiting until we get to AC. I
Yeah,
don't know.
you
Every
usually the
year
problem
that.
is the chairman of the Committee of Commissioners doesn't know what to do. Yeah, you're correct. You are correct.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. So that covers Overture 7, Overture 9. So I'd like to move to Overture 1, which is BCO. So this is Northern New England submitted an overture number 1. So they got it in closest to the last General Assembly. It gets listed in order, typically chronologically. That's how these numbers get assigned. And so number 1 from Northern New England to amend BCO 32-2 regarding investigations. Now, Fred and David both recommended votes in the negative on this. How are you voted? Are you recommending a vote in the affirmative? So I'm going to give you the first dibs here in terms of jumping in. What do you think about amending 32-2?
Well, it's an uphill climb because I've been in many SJC discussions with Fred and David on this issue, and we principally think differently. So I think it makes sense. It helps. We have had cases that someone brings a charge against someone else, and some people think, well, the presbytery has to adjudicate that charge unless it's clearly unsupported, or it's from a 31-8 accuser, or something like that. But normally, you have to adjudicate the charge. I'm of the position that Matthew 18 says, "Tell it to the church," but that doesn't mean tell them when you're going to appear as the prosecutor in that case. It's just tell it to the church and let the church decide whether it's an offense that warrants prosecution, whether it's provable at trial, whether it's, merits the amount of attention a presbytery would have to give to it or a session. So I'm very much in favor of Overture 1.
Okay. Fred?
Well, this is where I'm old enough to remember, I think the rest of you are too. Remember Crossfire, the old CNN show? Where they'd bring people on and would, argue back and forth. This is probably one of your most argue. It's interesting. This is a point of procedure, and this is probably where at least Howie and I have the greatest disagreement. As
Yeah.
Howie says, we've been fighting about this in SJC cases for a while. And Howie always brings up the, are you going to, have a trial for an 8-year-old who brings charges against his 10-year-old brother for hitting him? And my answer is yes, and the trial will last 5 minutes, and you go on. I think this is a really bad idea. I think it does away with voluntary prosecutors. I think it really has the unintended effect of insulating teaching elders from any layperson, because as soon as you enter into this process of Overture 1, any layperson loses standing to file a complaint if the presbytery declines to go forward. I think that's a very bad look in our modern age. I just think it's unnecessary. I've been preaching for years that 31-2 and 32-2 are not sequential. They are parallel.
Right.
And that's the way the SJC has ruled, for many a time. So I'm respectfully, but very as eager as Howie is for it, I'm eager against it.
Can I just ask to clarify, make sure that I'm setting this up right for those who are watching and aren't as familiar as the three of you with judicial process? So, if a church or a presbytery were to go to trial, there's often two routes to go to trial in our book. One route would be if that court does a 31-2 investigation based on a report and determines a strong presumption of guilt there to move to trial. That would be one avenue to get to a trial. So that's one route that you could take. And like if you're looking on Google Maps or Waze and it gives you an alternate route with the amount of time. The other route would be if a person, including a lay person or someone not a member of that court, arrives to the court with charges and said, I am filing charges against member X, then your understanding, if I'm reading this correctly, this overture would allow in that instance to kick back over to route one, something that Howie's in favor of. And Fred, your concern is that if you kick over to route one, that's going to become always a de facto route and route two will never be used. And then the net effect of that is the layperson doesn't actually have access to the court anymore versus right now they do have that. I think that would be a surprise because I think the average person, A, doesn't see a lot of trials to begin with, and then B, doesn't know that people outside the court would have access to do things like bring charges. Is everything that I just said, is that a fair summary? Would you correct something that I've said
I
or
think
edit it?
so. I think so. And I would only add one other thing. We don't see a lot of 32-2 charges because 31-9 exists. In other words, if someone becomes a voluntary prosecutor and they do it frivolously or without a probable cause, they can be censured. So in the main, in the PCA, I would say 90 out of 100 times, 95 out of 100 times, someone who's upset with someone else files a report and asks the court to do it on their own because they don't want to take the risk of being seen as a slander of the brethren. They don't want to take the risk of that under 31-9. So this is not, in my opinion, a rampant problem that needs to be fixed. We don't have people running around willy-nilly filing charges. As a matter of fact, if you look at like the last 12 controversies we've had in the last 15 years or so, they're all 31-2 controversies, not 32-2 controversies.
Right. And it could be 31-9. It could also just be people aren't familiar enough with process to know. And so a report is what just gets classified, right? Like it could be for a variety of reasons. The reason why I say that, Fred, is I don't think people outside of our courts are unfamiliar with the BCO, have much concern with 31-9 because they don't know what that says. Yeah, Howie.
Yeah, I think Fred brought up a legitimate point. I think that the problem could be solved in a simpler way, in a better way. So if Sally Jones files an allegation against Reverend John Doe, and Presbytery decides, for example, if this overture passed, Presbytery decides for whatever reason it doesn't warrant prosecution, she doesn't have BCO standing to file a complaint against that presbytery action. I think the solution to that isn't let her be a voluntary prosecutor just because she wants to be. The solution is grant standing to people who are personally offended and make accusations against ministers. Just grant them standing. That's what I would do. The book doesn't allow that yet, but I think that's the way to solve that problem.
David, do you have any thoughts that you want to weigh in? We've heard from Howie and Fred a bit.
Well, I don't think just as a aside on Howie's last point, I don't think you should change the Book of Church Order in a way that raises a problem with the anticipation that you could correct it later by changing some other part. That doesn't sound like a good strategy to me. But in any case, it seems to me there are many things wrong with this proposal, and not simply the loss of the bifurcation in 32-2 that is currently present. It seems to me that it is putting way too much credit with on B Book of Church Order 31-8. putting that into the mix. It's there, but it's relatively obscure. But if you go to that section, how is it that the court's going to conclude that somebody has one of those characteristics? The only thing there that has any reference to due process is one who is himself under censure or process. Every other one, the court would actually have to convict that person of being in some way characteristic in that way. And I think that's terrible. I mean, listen to the language again. If I can get to it here quickly.
You're about to read from BCO. I'm going to give you a second, just and then so people can follow. You're about to read the language from BCO 31, subparagraph 8, right?
That's
31A.
correct.
Okay.
Great caution ought to be exercised in receiving accusations from any person who is known to indulge in a malignant spirit toward the accused. How's the court going to know that?
They're going to investigate it.
Oh. And charge him and convict him who is not of good character. How's the court going to know that? Here's the only one that actually you could conclude. He's under censure or process. Next, who is deeply interested in any respect in the conviction of the accused?
But it sounds like you're objecting to BCO 31A.
I am objecting to it.
Oh.
I'm especially objecting to it now being put into the prerequisites of every case, which it's not there. It's somewhere else. To put it in here is going to highlight it, and I think in a way that is
So
destructive.
would you favor this if we just struck D?
I'd be more likely to favor it, but I still think that the problem that you and Fred say you're arguing about, I don't think is a problem. For this reason, every court has some plausible way in which they have discretion with respect to a case. Now you're identifying that discretion and in a way that is, I think, going to cause way more problems than it's ever going to solve. Right now, we have had SJC cases where, in fact, there's been an enumeration of elements of discretion. So right now, 31-2, we think we know what it means right now. And it means something that seems to me is largely agreeable to you and largely agreeable to Fred. But this new thing is going to be language that nobody knows how it's going to be construed. And in my judgment, likely in a way that's very damaging.
I would say that we had an SJC case this year that had a rare 12-12 vote. If this paragraph was changed, it would not have been a 12-12 vote. If this isn't changed, the next one will be a 12-12 vote.
I'm a little more optimistic than that, but in any case.
Okay.
Fair enough. Thanks to each of you for weighing in on this, and for sharing some backstory of the crossfire effect between Fred and Howie that's been going on for years that none of us apparently knew. Hey guys, it doesn't come out when we see you hug at General Assembly. Who would have known? Years and years of built-in 32-2 arguments happening there.
Listen, when we agree on so much, we've got to have violent disagreement about small provisions in the rules of discipline.
One of the things that would help in this discussion, and it wasn't in the whereas clauses, and I'm not sure I even put much of it in my rationale, is to come up with case law, case scenarios, like how would Fred and Howie deal with this differently? And if we come up with six and we both deal with them the same, then maybe nothing's needed to be fixed. And I think probably we could come up with six that the three of us would agree on. So, yeah, it's the to me, it's mainly I would be mainly concerned with someone who's alleging a personal offense and alleging a personal offense allegedly committed by a minister is the primary thing I think on the table. I don't think if someone makes an accusation that a minister is heretical and the presbyter looks at it and go, clearly he's not, certainly that wouldn't be prosecuted. So
If I could just, this seems to me to be a relatively important point. This is one of the principles that I articulated for thinking about overtures. There's a general objection to any proposed change in the Book of Church Order. Any new language will include undiscovered ambiguities that might well have disastrous unintended consequences. Consequences that will only appear when the provisions are tested in cases by sharp and contending minds seeking possible meanings to their advantage. Thus, unless the change proposed is clearly necessary, the older language is to be preferred because it already has been long tested in cases and persuasive precedents guide the church as to its meaning. This seems to me to be a case in point of that.
well, I would push back a little bit. I think something is necessary when you have an SJC that is 12 to 12 on a case. The book isn't helpful if an SJC is 12 to 12 on a decision. Something, I found that to be very uncomfortable, and think that something could fix that.
The where was the where was that your pen, David, that developed that consideration of how to look at
That's
changes?
my reflection on a very brilliant person that I'm not footnoting right now.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. What I appreciate about the conversation is that it seems like the concern for justice is shared by everyone, and the concern that the courts are faithfully used for the care of its people, shared by everyone. Everyone, we all agree on that. And I think what hopefully people here are hearing is a shared concern across the board that we are faithful in what God's called us to do, and yet trying to figure out how do you do that because life is messy. And cases, particularly cases that go up to SJC, are going to give you a way to show, yeah, this is messy and hard to work out. For the sake of time, I'm gonna move us on to Overture 1. No, that's what we were just talking about. I'm gonna move us on to Overture 22. Now, if you ever see an overture from the Pacific Northwest, I'm not personally guaranteeing. I'm not saying I know firsthand, but I'll just say there's a significant correlation between overtures from Pacific Northwest and Howie Donahoe, who has had a hand often in these or has contributed in some way. So Howie, for Overture 22, Pacific Northwest, BCO 20-3 on regular standing. Can you tell us on that overture? Now there was agreement here, so everyone affirmed that in your respective guides, but you just wanted to give you a chance to kind of speak to it.
Well, it was precipitated by an SJC decision on a case that arose in my presbytery. I didn't speak because you're disqualified when it's from your presbytery. It seemed there were, I mean, there were some dissenting judges, there were some concurring judges that said, we feel that the BCO constrains us to vote this way, but we'd like to see the change. And it's my understanding that there's a lot of churches that have minimum voting ages, and they're in kind of an awkward position. They're not sure what to do. I think when an SJC decision comes down, you heed it. But anyway, a lot of people maybe didn't even know the case came out. Nonetheless, a good bit of so following Dr. Coffin's recommendation that you better put some rationale in this thing.
Ha
We put some rationale in this thing touching on a
How
variety of different.
he's never been afraid of footnotes or rationale in anything he's ever written.
Well, a lot of the footnotes come from Dr. Bosserman, who did a lot of historical research. I'm not as much of a footnote guy, but so we just think it makes biblical sense. It makes common sense. It makes historical sense, and what Bosserman has written, I think it just part of it got posted on PC Day Polity, or summary of it. I just think it makes sense. Now, in discussions with other brothers, they have concerns that, I guess I could summarize. They're concerned that if this passes, it will encourage sessions to admit children to the Lord's Supper at a premature age. They're more likely, if this passes, to do that bad thing. And that's why, working with Fred, he came up with Overture 33. And my position is if Overture 33 helps this to become more palatable, I'm happy to endorse it. So.
Okay. We'll move to Overture 33 next because I think there's some connection
Okay.
there. But I just want to
Yeah.
make sure that before we do, Overture 22, any further thoughts from
Yeah,
Dean?
I mean,
Oh,
it
or
focuses
from Howie?
on a phrase, good and regular standing. And I think the SJC decision treated that as if good and regular standing referred to the same thing. And Bosserman's research points out that good standing is not under censure, regular standing is something else. So, for example, in the history of American Presbyterian, regular standing routinely meant a certain age. It actually meant financial contributions, stuff like that. So regular standing was a different animal than good standing. So that's a word. Now, minimum voting age is kind of a subset of regular standing. That's how. Anyway.
Thanks, Howie. David or Fred, anything further to add? I'll just note, I did some quick math, Howie. I want this to go into the record of our discussion, this third discussion. This overture, number 22, has 24 lines of the actual overture. Then it has 661 lines of rationale. So that's a pretty significant ratio.
Which is
24
why we're,
lines is the actual overture. 661
which is,
lines, because, since David Coffin encouraged you to show some rationale, you thought I
well,
better show more than just a little.
that's why we're confident, Your Honor, that the jury will vote in our favor.
Look, I encourage everyone who's watching to read, even though it may be hard, read all of it, and hopefully it's helpful to you. Okay, so Overture 33. Now, most of the overtures that we've described, and I qualified intentionally in the opening, that it's typical or common for overtures to come from presbyteries. I think this is the only overture that comes from the T.E. Fred Greco, Overture 33. And so I think it's only fair to let Fred kind of set the table. This would be an overture addressing exams, the questions from BCO 57. So, Fred, thoughts?
So the this came this comes from me because it was narrowly defeated in my presbytery. The main argument against it was we already do this, so we don't need this. I drafted this overture initially after discussions with Howie. He, as he will often do, actually we all do this. We share overtures in advance to try to come up with the best version even before it comes to assembly. So I saw Overture 22. I don't know, when did you start drafting it? Like in September or something like that. It was a long time ago. And my comment to Howie was, I don't see this passing two-thirds of presbyteries unless something is done here about the young communion issue. And Howie's raised that point in other contexts. Overtures, in order to become amendments to the book, need to not only pass assembly, but they need to pass two-thirds of presbyteries. And so I said, for me, for example, I would want to see this addressed. This concern, and I think it would help Overture 22. Hence, you see in our guides how he's saying yes on 33 if 22 passes, and me saying yes on 22 if 33 passes. They're kind of companions, and I think it's a good exercise in compromise that we've come about working on this together. So you'll also be interested to know that this is the short version of it. The long version of it came from David Coffin, and it was like a paragraph long. And David's long version was better than my short version, but using the principle that the more words in an overture, the less likely it is to pass, I went with the short version. And basically, my thought here is sessions, they should be doing this, because being admitted to the Lord's table is not just about whether someone's a Christian or not. Sometimes people think that if a session doesn't admit someone to the table, they're saying they're not a Christian. That's not what sessions are saying. Under 1 Corinthians 11, they have to not only make a profession of Christ, but they need to also say that they understand discerning the Lord's body, that is the supper and the church, hence the categories that I put in this language. Now, against my presbytery that said, well, we all already know this and are doing this, my thought is, number one, I'm not sure everybody's doing this. But number two, our Book of Church Order is not just a set of rules for courts to follow. It's an affirmative statement of our practice of Presbyterian polity. And the average layman probably doesn't know what's involved in the interview of a young person. And so it certainly can't hurt so that they know they're not going to be asked if they're super or infralapsarian. They're not going to be asked whether they're covenantal or dispensationalist. They're going to be asked, can they get profession of faith? Do they understand the supper? And do they understand what it means to be a member of a church? That's it. And so I think this would be very helpful. And while I understand Overture 22, because I've had lots of conversations with Howie, that Overture 22 is not designed to sneak young child communion in. And while I understand there are many churches that do this, I also understand that it has been a practice by some churches in the PCA to admit very young children using quote unquote age appropriate confessions that consist of something like Jesus loves me, not showing any understanding of the supper or of the church. And so, to me, that goes against our historical polity. And I think what virtually everyone would say is wise. So, while this probably comes under the category of doesn't absolutely have to be in the book, I think it's helpful. And I think it also will have the accedent benefit of helping Overture 22.
One thing to clarify, Joel, I don't, maybe I misheard you earlier. Fred's overture doesn't propose questions, if I read it right. It proposes conclusions that the session must reach. Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying, Howie. You're right.
Now they can ask those questions however they want, and they should assume that they're going to get age appropriate answers to them. But yeah.
I specifically tried, Joel, not to go into a lot of detail saying you have to ask question one and two and three, because anyone who's ever done a membership interview understands it's a process and you have to go back and forth. And we didn't want to, I didn't want to bind sessions. I just wanted to give them categories.
As someone who regularly does member interviews, let me say thanks, Fred. As someone who
Yeah.
moderates a session and does this with our elders, let me say thank you. Appreciate that.
I do think it's important what Fred has offered, and I think it's important for the session. The way I have thought about this is with categories of maturity. The child has to have intellectual maturity enough to make a credible, believable profession of faith. He has to have emotional maturity, that is to say, he is in some way or another capable of self-mastery with respect to participating in a rite, that he hasn't just gone through the motions. So it's not only understanding the table, but the capacity to take part in a ceremony maturely. And then finally, spiritual maturity, that you see in the child some sense of the woundedness of sin and the joy of redemption. Those three things seem to me to be critical for a session. And I would hope that what Fred has done will be passed, and we'll lead sessions to contemplate some things like that.
Two more things real quick, based on what David just said, and I think this is one way to summarize it, is you must have the requisite maturity to do both of those things. They just don't usually happen at the same age. But our book now constitutionally mandates, at least for the SJC decision, that they occur at the same age. So,
And you're suggesting by passing both these overtures that allow that it's basically stating now through the BCO how to navigate or balance those two things.
yeah, I think it demonstrates that you must have the requisite maturity to do each of those things, but it no longer has to occur at the same age. And the other reason I'm in favor of these, I think there's something beautiful about Fred and I negotiating a compromise and showing how this can, I feel like it's Reagan and Tip O'Neill or something. I don't know. I'll
Well,
be Tip O'Neill.
let's let this conversation go wide so that people hear some of the work that goes on, again, with trust, with believing others' intentions and what they're trying to do, and then operating, thinking the best and saying, okay, right, here's how this could be improved upon, or here's how this would fit. Thank you both. Thanks for your work on Overture 22 and 33. I think we've come to the end of what some of the set overtures that we wanted to talk about, again, in the context of quite a bit of an agreement among the group and hearing some of the areas where there are different thoughts. I'm going to just open it up. Are there any additional overtures that or comments on overtures that you think would be helpful before we close?
I don't have a lot of thoughts on adding our Committee on Christian Nationalism. Maybe the other guys do. I'm just kind of ambivalent, I guess.
Yeah, I think in my document, I'm recommending the letter because I think that's an easier, cheaper way to do it, using the information that we already have. I'm not sure that's something we need to study, to have a full-blown study paper on, but I do think it might satisfy some of the brothers in various areas of the country where it's a bigger concern to have a couple of page document to hand to congregant. I don't think it's essential. I'd rather see us do that than do a full-blown study committee.
So you're talking about Tennessee Valley 48,
Yeah.
and remind me, does that propose authorizing them to draft it or write something and propose it to the next GA? Because
Yeah,
I'm on Congress.
my
Okay.
guess is it's like the overture that I appointed a commission to write the letter on transgender minor procedures, but this would not be a commission. It would be a committee. The committee would bring it back to the 53rd Assembly for approval, is my understanding.
So, would they bring it back for approval and amendments from the floor? Presumably, the first thing they would say is remove that this be considered without debate, right? Dave Coffin
Well,
used to do it all the time. I love
yeah, I mean, I don't
it.
know. My guess
If
is that it
there's.
would actually come and it would be assigned by the clerk to the appropriate committee, which would probably be the overtures committee. And so it could be amended in overtures, but then couldn't be amended on the floor. That would be my understanding at this point.
Well, that should be put in this year's overture about how it gets back to the floor, because otherwise it wouldn't naturally go to the overtures committee because it's not an overture. But
Add in our
so
committee's report directly right
yeah,
now.
that's true. That's true.
Is this an
But you
ad hoc
would,
committee if it's not a study committee?
yeah,
Well,
any ad
okay.
interim could, yeah.
All right.
I'd hate to see the floor be committee of the whole on
No,
nouns and
no.
verbs, yeah.
Can we just say that it seems like there's a broad concern about Christian nationalism within the boundaries of the PCA affecting members, attenders at churches, or at least you're seeing that from Arizona, from South Texas, from Great Lakes, which is right. These aren't all the same pocket. They're different parts of the country expressing some concern that the PCA weigh in on this. I'll just say whatever that weighing in, whether it is restating some of the work that's been done historically or by our own denomination, whether that's developing a group of historians or men to think through how to address this now. It's rising up, it seems like, from different pockets, not just from the same spot.
Well, I just will repeat what I've said over and over again. I haven't seen study committees, except in very rare circumstances, do anything useful permanently. And often they do harm because they end up dividing, having a majority-minority report, and then nobody knows what we're about on it. I think that we have scholars and we have ministers and we have all kinds of people who can write useful things to help people understand, and we don't need to have the church doing it. And I don't think we need to have the church doing it on this. I mean, how many times anybody hand out the Freemasonry study report recently? I mean, well, there you have it.
All right. Any other comments? So that touches on a number of the, I think we've covered quite a bit of ground, but I don't want to cut off if there are comments or reflections on anything else. No? Okay. Hey, brothers, let me just say thank you so much for joining us. At AMR, our hope is that we can work toward both the unity and faithfulness of the PCA and doing that through conversations like this. Thanks for watching. Thanks for following the links to go and read and prepare. Our hope is that you have an extra resource here to get ready for the 52nd General Assembly, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Chattanooga. Take
Amen.
care.